This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
The progressive movement is full of lies. Why do Americans keep falling for the deception? In his new book, Liars, Glenn Beck reveals the simple answer, fear.
At our most basic level, we're all afraid of something. And progressives exploit this by offering us solutions to our fears. Solutions based on lies and an unrelenting hunger for power and control. Understanding the roots of these lies is key to helping us stop the disease of progressivism.
Liars by Glenn Beck. On sale now at glennbeck.com/liars.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where me, your rabbi, that's me, Rabbi Daniel Lappin, dedicated and devoted to solemnly reveal how the world really works. And one of the ways the world really works is that power is incredibly seductive. There is a connection between power and sex. There really is. And we'll discuss that in more detail in another show. But for right now, suffice it to say that both are incredibly seductive and equally irresistible. And when people have power, they will do absolutely anything to protect it and increase it. And really, if you want yet another sense of, number one, why Donald Trump, in spite of his imperfections and in spite of the unease and the difficulties and the challenges and in spite of so many doubts that so many people have about him, the reason that I think he is going to win, the reason that so many people are backing him, and you know, you can argue about a poll here or a poll there, 3 points up, 4 points down, but we're talking about millions and millions of Americans who are supporting him. Look, part of the reason is the kind of thing that has just been going on. I don't know if you remember, but last year, Governor Scott Walker was subjected to a political stalking and an assault by John Chisholm, who's the Milwaukee District Attorney, a left-wing liberal, who attempted to suppress free speech, basically prosecuted allies of Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And it failed. But as the Wall Street Journal reported, John Chisholm, the DA in Wisconsin, could not accept that. And they began, they spent nearly a year working up a campaign to beseech the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. And they actually did get the Supreme Court to hear the case, amazingly enough. They did. And the Supreme Court, look, it was a long shot, but the Supreme Court actually came down on the side of goodness. The good guys won. And look, it was a close thing. And this is one of the reasons that we are and should be enormously concerned about more liberals on the United States Supreme Court. That's really one of the main things. I mean, gosh, this was a combined military campaign on the part of the liberal leadership in Wisconsin to try and destroy Scott Walker and all those who supported him. And this was a very disturbing case. Had they won on the Supreme Court, the results, you know, people said it'll be chilling. Well, this would have been a lot worse than chilling, I can tell you that. But this is the kind of thing that does go on. And then along similar lines, but only worse, what the Wall Street Journal calls America's worst attorney general abuses his office to aid Clinton. And that is right. There's a guy called Eric Schneiderman who truly must believe that anything may be done all rules may be broken, all decency may be trampled upon, all honor and the expected behavior of elected officials. For heaven's sake, the Attorney General of New York and what he is doing by trying to create out of whole cloth a scandal over Donald Trump's charitable foundation. There is no limit to what they're doing. He's forced them to cease raising money, and he gave them 15 days to turn over mountains and mountains of papers, including audited statements. And Schneiderman, Attorney General Schneiderman, wrote, "A failure to comply will be deemed a fraud upon the people of the state of New York." Look, the idea was to begin a whole round of bad headlines for Trump, and obviously the New York Times and Washington Post quickly complied in partnership with Schneiderman. And look, the point, let me finish off the Wall Street Journal. I'll just read you the last paragraph of the Wall Street Journal's point. "New York citizens deserve to be protected from abuse of the prosecutorial kind that Mr. Eric Schneiderman is exercising to swing an election. The irony is that Mr. Trump's critics keep telling us that he must be defeated because he poses a unique threat to the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. What about the abuses that Mr. Schneiderman is practicing now? Where's all the liberal outrage about that?" And that's really one of the things that concerns me. I do think that there is prosecutorial abuse in America. I think prosecutors are out of control. I think they've become very much part of the political process on the left. And look, I've got a friend, Adam, who puts it very well. And he said, look, voters this year wanted a candidate on the right. Conservative voters wanted a candidate with energy and pugnacity. That's what they wanted. They wanted somebody, they wanted a pit bull, not a poodle. And unfortunately, the behavior of Republican leadership over the last few years has been that of poodles, not pit bulls. And this is very disturbing to those of us who are frightened for the future of the country. It's a problem. And the whole primary season began to, as you'll remember, was a conflict between the conservative base, scorning many of the intellectuals and many of the Republican politicians as effete and ineffective. But even more than that, there is the sense of the left is abusing power and the right is not taking it on. And so I gave you the example of this witch hunt conducted by the Milwaukee County District Attorney in Wisconsin against John Chisholm, District Attorney John Chisholm, against Governor Scott Walker and his allies. And when Chisholm lost in court last year, he went ahead and spent a year trying to get the Supreme Court to pick it up, which they did, and finally he lost. But here's the question. Did John Chisholm really lose? I mean, yeah, he lost in court. But think about what's really happened. In other words, what I'm going to make the case is we lost, conservatism lost. In 2011, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who you all know, he actually passed a reform package that severely cut back the power of state public employee unions. The left went berserk. There was even a union-led recall effort. Do you remember that? And District Attorney John Chisholm of Milwaukee County, who's a super partisan liberal. His wife is a teachers' union leader, so he tried to get revenge by attacking Governor Scott Walker and the people who supported him. And on the pretext of searching for campaign finance violations, Chisholm launched a very, very oppressive investigation of all conservative groups. And the state had a sort of a John Doe law, which is being changed now, that allowed him to keep the identities of the targets sealed and the targets muzzled. The state Supreme Court described the investigation's flavor this way. Millions of documents, both in digital and paper copy, were subpoenaed by John Chisholm. They were seized. Deputies seized business papers, computer equipment, phones, and other devices. Documents were subpoenaed and seized without regard to content or relevance to the alleged violations. As part of this dragnet, the special prosecutor also had seized wholly irrelevant information, such as retirement income statements, personal financial account information, personal letters and family photos, etc. It's terrible. And the seizures, by the way, were performed in the shock and awe manner normally used for large-scale drug raids. The targets were marched out of their homes. Right? And these are conservative activists who run organizations and public policy institutes, marched out of their homes in the middle of the night, held on the street by police. Neighbors came out and looked. And the state law in Wisconsin, which was designed in order to come down on conservative organizations, doesn't allow targets from explaining to their neighbors the reason for the search. Imagine what that does to you. Your neighbors see you handcuffed in the streets, and you're not allowed to explain it. Not only did the prosecutor not even have any good faith basis to suspect the targets of any crime, but everyone knows, as it turned out, and the court actually ruled, the seizures were nothing but a fishing expedition. It was horrible. And meanwhile, as I told you, Eric Schneiderman, the state attorney general of New York, issues a cease and desist order to Trump's charitable foundation. And the Wall Street Journal, as I read to you, called this the latest misuse of his prosecutorial authority to attack his political enemies. Schneiderman is another hyper-partisan Democrat, active supporter of Hillary Clinton, and his whole power play is corruption. It's pure and simply corrupt. And the point we've got to understand is that hard left folks around the country, anywhere in the country, have set up sanctuary cities, not only for illegal immigrants, but also for partisan left-wing prosecutors. In other words, there are many, many states and cities around the country now where left-wing prosecutors run wild. And, you might say, as the Wall Street Journal said, where's the liberal outrage? Yeah, right, what a joke. And the alarming thing, and this is what I want to remind you of, you know, a lot of people were celebrating, the Supreme Court, the court ruled in favor of Scott Walker and everything. But John Chisholm still won because the good guys had to spend fortunes to defend themselves. Their reputations were damaged. Their fundraising ability was severely damaged. And enormous political progress was made by the left. The same thing is true with Eric Schneiderman in New York. It's not going to turn out to be anything, I assure you. I am absolutely certain that this is going to be nothing but a prosecutorial attempt to make a case against Trump. And it's not gonna hurt Trump in the long run. Okay, it's not gonna make a difference. Where it does make a difference is politically. What it does do is force Trump to devote time, money, and energy to defending these ludicrous charges. It also gives ammunition to left-wing papers around the country. Bottom line is, look, the left is out of control in America. The idea that it's still a 50-50 fight. Sometimes they win, sometimes we win. I don't think that's true anymore. And that's why I do believe that if Hillary wins, it is all over. Right now, it's bad enough. Will Trump fix it up? I have absolutely no idea. But I do know that with Hillary, it's finished. That's for sure. And the one thing we can say about Donald Trump, and if you don't want to, I will, and that is he's not a poodle. He's a pit bull. Now, pit bulls, can be good and bad. There are two flavors to pit bulls. If you want your life and property defended, a pit bull is a wonderful thing to have. If you are wandering down the street minding your own business and somebody's pit bull is out of control and non-disciplined and not where he belongs, then that's very bad. And I don't know, obviously, what we're dealing with on that side of things. I don't know where things are going to go with Donald Trump if he wins, but I do want him to win simply because I know without a shadow of a doubt where things go under Hillary, which is greater government power, more prosecutorial abuse, and more destruction of the Constitution, more destruction of separation of powers, more destruction of the values that I not only believe in, but that I believe are vital for our nation's survival. Now, one of the remarkable things about the United States of America is that it creates citizens of enormous dedication and enormous idealism. And many, when I say many, you know, overall the numbers are not huge, but they're significant in the Jewish community. Part of that American idealism, which flows from the earliest days of the War of Independence, and has always been a part of American culture. You know, lots of Americans went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. You know, again, many of them on the wrong side, but there was an idealism involved. And much of the Jewish idealism that America has helped to cultivate finds expression in large numbers for the Jewish community of remarkable young families that leave the comforts of America and move to immigrate to Israel. And many of them move to very uncomfortable places, new settlements, places that the United Nations and many of the left-wing intelligentsia of America regard as obstacles to peace. And they're living there, and they don't have the comforts and the luxuries they had in the United States of America. But I had an opportunity to have breakfast with a number of these couples, and I decided to pull out my tape recorder and talk to them for a few minutes in the hope that you would find their, well, their idealism as refreshing as I did. And so if you don't mind, and I hope you enjoy it, that's what we're going to be doing just as soon as we get back from the break. Don't go away.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
If you're in the market for a new mattress, casper.com/rabbi should be the next website you visit. Casper created an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's one perfect mattress, and it's sold directly to you, eliminating the need to endure one of those commission salesman mattress stores with inflated prices. Casper is shipped for free right to your door, astonishingly delivered in a sleek, how-did-it-fit-in-there box. You just let it unfold, and there you have it, one of the most supportive sleep surfaces ever designed. Hassle-free. Casper is made in America, and Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. Breathable latex and memory foams are combined for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Try Casper for 100 nights free, and if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Right now, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/rabbi. That's casper.com, promo code rabbi. Terms and conditions apply. casper.com/rabbi.
With stories in the areas of family, friendship, faith, and finance, this is Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Only on the Blaze Radio Network on demand.
It is the Rabbi Daniel Lapin Show again. Thank you so much for being part of the show, where your rabbi reveals how the world really works. Every now and then, of course, even I get surprised by ways in which the world really works, ways in which I hadn't anticipated. And I certainly didn't anticipate that this morning I would be having breakfast in a home on a hilltop about 30 or 40 miles east of Tel Aviv, an area known as the Occupied Territories. And that would mean that I am now in a settlement. You probably imagine that I'm sitting down and having breakfast in a caravan on rickety wheels that somebody has towed illegally in the middle of the night. But as a matter of fact, I'm in the middle of a thriving town with beautiful tree-lined streets, with gorgeous single-family homes with tended gardens and kids running around and schools with like 700 or 800 children in them. And the reality is very, very far from the depiction. But the reason that I am taping the show right now is that I'm privileged to be sitting with three families who in the last few years have made their home here, families from the United States of America, families that are Jewish and Bible-believing and observant, who picked up from comfortable, may I say, upper middle-class lifestyles. One family from San Francisco, another family from Seattle, third family from Dallas, a fourth family. I'm trying to think where Greg and Maya are from. My wife Susan is here. You'll remember Mrs. Lappin, the one who is a crack shot with a 357 Magnum. That Greg, you guys, yeah, also really Seattle, the Seattle area, and you know, when you say how the world really works, look, folks, the way the world really works is that people who have it made in comfortable homes, in good careers, in nice cities in the United States, do not pick up and move their families to a hilltop between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. You just don't do that. And so I thought that you might be as interested as I've been to hear some of these people talking about their lives a little bit, and a little bit about what made them move, how this comes about. And having made the move, do you ever sit around and say, were we crazy? Are we mad? What got into us? Why on earth would we have left Dallas or San Francisco or Seattle to come here? What is going on in the minds of these families? I can tell you that they look younger than they did back in the States, and I knew them all in the States. Their faces seem suffused with an exuberance and a joy, and I'm trying to get this clear. I'm trying to get this in their words so you get a little bit of a sense of what it is that is really going on here. So I'm going to start off with Mike and Bloomer. I'm going to let them tell their story themselves, briefly starting off, but I will tell you that Mike was born in the old Soviet Union and came to the United States, and as a grateful new citizen, he served as a United States Marine, and once a Marine, always a Marine. And he married Blumen. They've got a beautiful family, and they just left Dallas only a few months ago and settled on this hilltop in the occupied territories. So let's go over to you, Mike, and talk just a little bit about, first of all, your background, and then we'll have your wife tell her background. But I want to hear what... How did this come about, and you've been here 2 months now? Any regrets?
Thank you, Rabbi. No regrets. We have been here, like you said, 2 months, and we really have not looked back. We feel so blessed and fortunate to be here, and just really alive and enthused by the spirituality that we feel here. It's just been amazing, and the community is wonderful, the people are wonderful, and we're a part of something. You know, you ask, so the real question, why did we do it? Why do we leave our beautiful community in Dallas, you know, our nice big five-bedroom home with a swimming pool, and my nice job as a civil engineer? Why do we come here? You know what, the answer lies in that we wanted to be the players on the field and not the spectators in the arena. There's hundreds of thousands of spectators, but only a few players on the field. And we, living here, we feel that we're actually on the team playing the game and not just spectating it from the sidelines.
And your wife, Bloomer, sophisticated psychologist in Texas, and now, well, still a sophisticated psychologist, but you're now a settler. What's this all about?
Right. I actually don't feel like a settler. I feel like an Israeli. I feel like we came here because God spoke to us. And I don't say that about, you know, I don't say that lightly. We feel that God literally said, you need to move to Israel for your children. We feel that we are immigrants, and my husband, of course, knows all about what that's like, watching his parents be, you know, not knowing the language and not understanding the culture and having to struggle through all of that. And we will probably always struggle a little bit with that, but we know that our children are going to be, like Mike said, players on the field. They are going to join the IDF. They are going to be a part of the Jewish people in a way that a person is not capable of being outside of Israel. That's a gift that we feel like we have gotten. And they say, I think it's in Torah, that you acquire the land. You're not given the land. It's not a gift. It's not like anybody can come here and make it. Plenty of people try to come and they don't. And they go back and they struggle back there too, because I would think that they want to be in both places. It's comfortable outside of Israel. It's comfortable in America. And it's not comfortable here. You have to work for it. You have to fight for it. And I think that God picks just each and every person to come here and make a difference. That's what I think.
Yeah. Susan was just saying that she wanted to hear you, Mike, on this question. You were born in a socialist regime, and you grew up as an American. You've lived up till now as an American. I think I can safely say that your politics are on the right end of conservative.
Yes.
And and now you're living in a country that that at least was founded by unreconstructed Bolsheviks. This is a country that was founded on the principles of socialism. Do you run into any of that here still? And if so, how do you react to that?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is in many ways a socialist country, and I can't stand the bureaucracy. I couldn't stand it in America, and I couldn't. It's hard to stand here. That's one of the evils of socialism is the bureaucracy and the lack of motivation that government employees have. They know they're still going to get a paycheck whether they work or they don't work, whether they process a form in 2 hours or 2 weeks. They're still going to get paid. So there's no incentive. There's no motivation. So that really bothers me, especially with my military background and my American work ethic. And so it is one of the evils here, but nevertheless, this is family, and just like that weird uncle that everybody has to put up with, we've got our own weird relatives, and and their stuff that we deal with.
Yeah. Steve is someone else who moved from San Francisco. Arrives in Israel. Here is a guy who is a sophisticated guy. He's an advertising executive, living in the dream life. San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, Baghdad on the Bay, and you're now living on a mountaintop. Want to hear a little bit about what brought you and your family here? How that happens? And also, while you're at it, you said something a little earlier while we were having breakfast. You said that people who trade, people who do business together, don't fight together. And I think you're exactly right about that, of course. But why would it be that here you are, you're in a settlement, right? People call it a settlement, as I mentioned earlier. It's an extremely established, it's a beautiful town. I'm trying to think what part of the United States this would remind me of, but it could be a neighborhood in Broward County or in Palm Beach County, more like it in Florida. This could also be a street in Palo Alto. It's more hilly, of course. I mean, here we are on a hill. But just down the hill, there's a unkempt, sewage-ridden village of Arabs who would like to kill you. Why are we not trading? Why is that not happening? Why is trade not solving everything here?
So I'm going to answer the first question first and then get on to talking about the Arabs. So I had a wonderful career in San Francisco. We had, I couldn't have wished for anything more. I was in the top 5% of earners in the U.S. But we looked around and we saw the environment that we were bringing our kids up in. And we saw that it wasn't right. And we started thinking about, oh, what are they going to do? You know, who are they going to marry? Where are they going to end up? And how are they going to live their lives? And about a year and a half ago, came to visit Ellie and Judith here. I was here for 3 days and, you know, drove across the Green Line. I thought, oh, it's not too bad. It's like I grew up in South Africa. You know, you just got to watch yourself. And I arrived in this town and the people, and I just knew that this was the place to be. And on the way home, on the way to the airport, I called up my wife, Phoebe, and I said to her, darling, we're moving to Israel. And that was it. We knew we had to do it for the children. We had to give them an environment that was true to life. It wasn't about the externalities and the entertainment and everything, that, you know, all this false stuff. This is as real as it gets right here. As you walk out the fence, there's somebody who wants to kill you. This is, you know, this, we are taking our land back. And if we look at it from that side, we're standing on the shoulders of giants here in Israel who've given up their lives over the years of, you know, to establish the state. We had to do something as well. We had to be part of that, like Mike and Bloomer said. We have to be part of this generation that are coming in here and are taking back the land that God promised to us. And that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I saw that I could earn a living here. I saw that this was the right place for the kids. So we made the move. And the kids are loving it. It's been fantastic. You know, there's certain things I miss about American society. There's a lot of things I miss about San Francisco because it's a beautiful place. I surfed. I miss that terribly. I love the Pacific Ocean. But I would give it up again and again and again for my children, for their future, and for living here amongst these wonderful people. Mm-hmm. It's very important to me.
Let's take a quick pause there before we go back to the next question, if you don't mind, Stephen. We'll do that. The website, of course, is rabbidaniellappin.com. And is there anything special we want to tell people about?
The holiday closing and opens. We've got, you said last week it was, you thought it would be a few days. It's actually because we're still closing and opening.
Yeah, right. We're in the middle of the holiday period. For those of you who are listening in close to the release date of this particular show, we're still in the Jewish month of Tishrei, the month where we start off with Rosh Hashanah, the new year, followed by the Day of Atonement 10 days later. And then 5 days after that comes the holiday of Tabernacles, which, by the way, is a time of massive Christian pilgrimage to Jerusalem. It's really rather remarkable. I can't tell you how many fans from our TV show and from the podcast we run into on the streets of Jerusalem during the Tabernacle holidays. But of course, what it does mean is that since we do not conduct any business, not only on Saturdays, but also on Jewish holidays, our stores are shut. And Susan reminds me that we have a special sale price, right?
$20.
To compensate those of you who have trouble. What happens is you go to our website, and if it happens to be on a Jewish holiday, and there's a whole lot of them this month, you're going to get a sign saying, unfortunately, closed for business until such and such an hour at such a date. And but on the other hand, you might hit it when we're open. So best thing, head over to youneedarabbi.com, which is the same as rabbidaniellappin.com, because the rabbi you need, I humbly submit, is me. Go over to the store section, and this is a really good time to take advantage of the library pack, which is the sum total of all my teachings to date, and you can easily obtain all of that. Best opportunity. I know what you're thinking. Some of you are saying, wait a second, I've already got biblical business secrets from the Bible, or I've got marriage secrets from Eden. Madam, I'm Adam. That may be true, and you're going to get them again if you get the whole library pack. But it's going to be like getting those things for free. And guess what? I know that somewhere in your orbit, friends, family, somewhere there's someone you love enough to want to bless with a resource that has the capacity to change their lives. RabbiDanielLappin.com, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
There's still more to come from Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Don't miss the Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip.
Little Bibby out of Chicago.
Lil.
Anything you do with them people is snitch. I don't care if somebody shot your mama. I ain't calling no police. I'm not talking with them.
Even under the circumstances of your mom being shot in the face, you don't talk to the police, Ty.
It's not that they want to hurt cops. They don't want to interact with cops in any way, shape, or form under any circumstance.
The Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip. Weekday mornings, 6 to 9 Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
We now return with Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Yes, we're back, the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where your rabbi reveals how the world really works here in a beautiful city in the Shomron. This is the part known as the West Bank or the Occupied Territories. Folks, we are all the victims of massive propaganda and indoctrination on this. And I really urge those of you who are visiting Israel in the near future, make a point of visiting this part of the country. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do, and I only do this for my closest friends. If you're going to be going to Israel and you're already booked and you're set to go, contact me through the website at rabbidaniellappin.com. And yeah, there's a place there to contact us. You go ahead and contact me and tell me you're coming, and I will put you in touch with people that will tell you and guide you and show you how to see this part of Israel that is seldom on the official tourist itineraries. The Green Line, as Steve from San Francisco said a moment ago, the Green Line is nothing. It's not real. It's a line on a map. It means absolutely nothing. And in terms of people's lives, you're missing out on some of the most passionate, exciting, exhilarating people you're likely to meet. And those are the folks who chose to come to Israel, not to live in Tel Aviv, not to live in Jaffa or Haifa or not even in Jerusalem, but they are the pioneers. This is the Wild West, in a way. This is the new frontier. This is where people with excitement flowing in their veins instead of blood, this is the place where people who live and breathe passion in Israel, this is where they come. And you literally, you just feel it among the people you meet and in the very air you breathe. And Steve, advertising executive out of San Francisco, originally born in South Africa, lived in the United States for many, many years, raised his family in the United States, picks up and moves to the Shomron, moves to a a settlement. Calling this place a settlement, honestly, is like calling Manhattan a village. It doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. But it's a beautiful town and extremely well-developed and safe and clean and lovely. Steve, I asked you a little bit about the fact that, you know, here you are raising your family, and this is beautiful. It's just as I've described. But on our way here, when Ellie drove us here last night, you know, he'd just casually toss out. He'd sort of point his thumb out the window and say, you know, that's the Arab village where they captured some Jews a few years ago. This is the Arab village. I mean, you're surrounded. There are Arab villages everywhere here, in case you hadn't noticed. And those guys don't like you very much at all. In fact, their lifestyle is one of violence and barbarism, and killing you is an easy option for them. How do you feel?
I'm very wary, and you have to have your wits about you all the time. There are people out here who absolutely, as you said, want to kill you, and if they had the chance, they would do it. But on the other side, there's also a lot of very good people who live out here who just want to get on there with their lives. And one of the things I've seen is that, you know, through trading with them, going into these villages, you know, carefully, sometimes with a protected armed guard or with one of the other Arab guys, there's some very, very decent people here who are raising their families as well and are running businesses honestly. And through trading with them, I find that you break through a lot of barriers. One of the things, I dropped a guy that we work with in an Arab village called Funduk, and we were waiting for his brother to turn up to come pick him up, and I was surrounded by four or five Arab guys, and they were all wishing me a wonderful Rosh Hashanah coming up. And there's some really, really decent people here. And I have no problems dealing with them and trading with them. And that's where I think the future will be, the future that we have with peace. If we can get rid of the guys that really just, as you say, just see barbarism as the way forward, we have to get rid of them in some sort of way. I don't know how. It's a very difficult problem. But knowing there's a core of people who want to be here, who want to trade with us, who want to raise their families, mm-hmm. and create a civilized society is very, it makes me feel better about living here. Mm-hmm.
Things you and your wife look back on? You've been here, what, about a year now? A year and a half?
About a year and a half.
Do you ever think back to San Francisco and the Bay Area, or is life so passionate and so fulfilling here that it's almost like a dream from the past?
I am so privileged to be here. I look and I think that I'm one of the first generations that have had the opportunity to come and live in Israel. And why would you not take that opportunity? I don't look back.
The relationship with Arabs, with Palestinians, this is something that has deteriorated over the last 20 years or thereabouts. Things used to be better. And many of the folks living here and in other parts of Israel have told me of how there were comfortable interactions, the Arab villages, the Jewish towns, and things are now much worse than they used to be, brought about by really one simple event in history, misguided, driven by a utopian left-wing liberalism dream. You might remember motorist Rodney King, whose mantra was, "Hey man, can't we all just get along?" Well, apparently motorist Rodney King himself was also incapable of just getting along with anyone, actually. And there was a dream of, well, imposed from Washington, D.C., that is, why can't we just all get along? And the result has been much worse than anyone could possibly have anticipated. And to speak about that for a little bit, here is a couple that, of the couples I'm with this morning, this couple has been here the longest. 6 years, is it? 6 years ago, they left Seattle and made their home here in the land of Israel. Ellie and Judith. Ellie, first, if you wouldn't mind, just address that. Why are things so much worse with the Arabs than they used to be?
Thank you very much, Rabbi. The Oslo Peace Accords was signed in 1993 through the assistance of President Clinton. That would be Bill Clinton, if that needs clarification at this point. Yitzhak Rabin, the late Prime Minister of Israel, and Yasser Arafat. And what President Bill Clinton did at the time was he legitimized Yasser Arafat, who at the time the world understood was a terrorist, an unrepentant terrorist. And what the Oslo Peace Accords did was it set in motion the idea that the area that we're in right now, the disputed territories, would go in motion towards eventually becoming a pathway towards a two-state solution of creating a Palestinian state. Prior to that, the Israelis, the Jews, had entered into this area, a semblance of sovereignty, from 1967 to 1993. During that span of 26 years, the Arabs understood that the Jews were in charge. The Arabs had attacked the Israelis, they attacked the Jews. The Jews repelled them, and not only did they repel the attack, but they took over the land relatively easily. And from that point on, there was a sense that they understood who was in charge. Once Israel capitulated to President Clinton and to the greater international community and said, we're going to give the Palestinians, give the Arab world, what they could not achieve on the battlefield in the diplomatic world, all of a sudden they understood a certain moral lack that was in within Israel. And it translated into some very practical differences in the day-to-day life between the Israelis and the Palestinians. As a perfect example, a community that we drove by yesterday was a community of Ofra. Ofra is a community where many Israeli prophets lived in biblical times. Directly across the street, literally 50 feet away, is a Palestinian town called Ein Yabrud. And prior to 1993, approximately half of the Israelis in Ofra would do their banking in banks in the Palestinian towns. Ein Yabrud is basically a suburb of Ramallah. The idea that Israelis or Jews who have a rabbi and they know how to manage their money would leave their life savings in a bank account in a Palestinian town nowadays is laughable. It would never happen. But prior to 1993, this was commonplace. And that is one of the fallacies of, as you described, the utopian diplomatic resolution that would create a Palestinian state. It seems like a very kindergarten-esque kind of solution to a real spiritual problem. It's not just a material problem. It's never been about land. It's always been about two different ideologies, which are meeting sometimes in the battlefield, sometimes in the diplomatic world, and sometimes, as Steve was saying just before, sometimes even at the one-on-one basis. And that is where Israel failed. And that is where Israel needs to improve itself, to strengthen itself, and to create a certain level of semblance and control in this area.
And going to your wife, Judith, now. So yeah, here you are, you guys, you know, living the dream life in the United States of America. Your families established there. Ellie, your family in the Washington, D.C. area. Judith, your family in New York, San Francisco. And there you are. You're now in Israel. 6 years, you're living in the Shomron, in the occupied territories. And you spoke a little bit earlier, and I'd love you to address that for me just as soon as we get back from this quick break. I want Judith to just talk a little bit about emotionally, just how does it feel for a woman to leave her family in the United States, leave her everything she's known, and to bring three young daughters across oceans to really, you know, the Wild West isn't a completely ridiculous metaphor. It doesn't look like the movies of the Wild West, obviously, but I will tell you that I get a little, as we were driving through some of these areas last evening, whenever an Israeli army, an Israel IDF truck came by bristling with machine guns, I must say, I thought to myself, oh, okay, that's good. I mean, if anything, you know, if our car breaks down in the next Arab village, it's kind of nice to know those guys will be along next, you know. So in that sense, it is a little bit wild. But love for you to talk about that, Judith, just as soon as we get back. The website, youneedarabbi.com. And head over to the store. The library pack is on sale. Great time to get that right now. Your Rabbi, revealing how the world really works, back with you in just a moment.
Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Don't miss Pat and Stu.
18 she doesn't look 18 there either, but as soon as she becomes Miss Teen USA.
Did you just give Jeffy's slogan on the air without crediting him?
Did I?
I was the thing. Thank you.
Debbie's slogan is she doesn't look under 18, I told you. And then you kind of have to.
Pat and Stu, weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Blaze Radio Network On Demand with Rabbi Daniel Lapin.
Before we get to Judith, everybody, and here we are back with the Rabbi Daniel Lapin show, Greg, a lawyer from Seattle, again, picks up a family, young children, moves all the way across the world to a mountaintop between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And love to have you, Greg, just talk for a few moments. I know you've got to get going. You're going to build your sukkah. Okay, sukkah is the little booth that we Jews build to live in during the Holiday of Tabernacles, which will be starting this coming Sunday night, as of when I'm recording the show right now. But here's Greg to talk about his move and what are he and his wife thinking as they pick themselves up and come here.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's been an exciting 3.5 months since we decided to make the move. As you pointed out, we left a profession that was putting us in some of the top earnings in the U.S. We had a beautiful home on an island in the Pacific Northwest. Kids going to private school, drove a beautiful luxury car, and decided to give it all up. And one of the things that I'm quick to point out when I speak to friends back in the U.S., we didn't leave because of a lack of love for the U.S. One of the first questions I was asked by my family was, do you have to give up your U.S. passport? And the answer is no. They'll take it from me when it's my cold hands. I love that country. I grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance every morning to that flag, and I do very much love the United States of America. But as a Jew and as a father, it became important to me to make sure that I wasn't getting so caught up in those parts of the U.S., the things about it that affected me spiritually, that I got stuck. And so when my wife, who had been born in Israel but had not been religious at the time, said that it was our opportunity to not only make Aliyah, which is the move to Israel, but to live out in the settlements and amongst friends that had also made the move, we decided it was time not just to trust in each other, but to trust in God that we would be okay out here surrounded by dangerous neighbors. And in the brief time that we've been here, we have been okay. We look at what's going on in the U.S. right now. It's the election season, depending on when you're listening to this. And it's a little bit disconcerting to see the character attacks and the lack of policy issues being discussed at a time when the world really needs quality leadership from America. It's disheartening to see that. And all we really can do from out here in this part of the world that we call the Shtachim is to pray and to try to set a good example. And one of the things that we learn is that we should try to live amongst righteous people, and we should try to have our values set properly. And one of the values that I've learned since being out here is have a lot of respect for the people that built this place, those who drained the swamps or fought in the wars or did those things that we don't really have to do. We do get to live in the type of neighborhood that, Rabbi, you described so well, single-family homes that are so beautiful, the streets that are paved, you know, places where it's safe for our kids to play. And despite the neighbors, we've got quality security and the fences around our community that allows us to feel safe. We had a truck go by last night, just to set an example, a loudspeaker blaring on top of it with an indecipherable language, since I don't speak any Hebrew yet. And had it been maybe 70 years earlier, it might have been somebody warning us that the Germans were approaching and we needed to be prepared for tomorrow. Instead, when I asked my wife to decipher what the loudspeaker was saying, she said it's a truck going around and announcing that there's a blood drive and that they'd like for people to come out and give blood. And I thought, that's exactly why we're here. This is the type of community that wants to make sure that nobody should ever go without having a pint of blood when they need it, and that we can feel safe knowing that Hashem will protect us. Those of us who have been trained or who guard the perimeter are here to protect us, and that we're part of something much bigger. We just concluded both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we see in the liturgy that we're fulfilling part of the prophecy that says that we will be gathered back to the land of the Shamron, and that's where we are.
So as you can tell, I mean, there's considerable passion on the part of people. I mean, you know, nobody seems to have moved here for logistical reasons. Nobody's moved here for materialistic reasons. Whomever I talk to, it's always the same. It's because I feel part of Jewish history. I feel connected with the Bible. I feel connected with the people. But Last night, I must tell you, and I regret not recording last night, actually, but last night I had an opportunity to meet with a group of Christians led by Pastor Tommy Waller and his wife. These are friends of yours, Ellie, and maybe just describe a little bit about this remarkable group of Christians that come over every year. I can't tell you how uplifting and how inspiring it all was being part of that program last night. I want Ellie to tell you just a little bit about that because he introduced me to them, and it really left an indelible imprint on my soul. And then after that, we'll hear from his wife, Judith.
Thank you, Rabbi. Tommy Waller is a farmer from Franklin, Tennessee, who traveled to Israel about 12, 13 years ago, saw the land of Israel, saw the land of the Bible, immediately connected to it as any Christian or any Bible-believing person would. But he took it to the next level, and he literally imagined himself fulfilling the words of the Bible. And he was particularly struck by a verse in Jeremiah that described a time when the Jewish people came back to the land and how the land would respond. But on top of that, there was a caveat that there would be the stranger who would be assisting the Jewish farmer. And Tommy immediately said, that's going to be him. And what started out as a cute biblical interpretation has become now a lifelong dream and fulfillment. And it's been through his family. He has a family, a devoted wife, and 11 devoted children, and I believe now 15 devoted grandchildren, and at least a couple on the way. And one of the things that we noticed last night was that the entire family is part of his ministry enterprise, the entire family. And it is remarkable what he has done, as he has created a ministry where he encourages Christians to spend some time in Israel, pay their own flight, pay their own way, to come and to only volunteer and pick grapes and harvest olives and whatever the Jewish farmer needs, Christians are there to help out. They ask for no payment. They ask for nothing other than the spiritual benefits of being in the land and fulfilling the prophecy.
There must have been about 300 people there last night, Ellie. It was amazing.
Not only the 300 people there last night, but from the entire harvest season, which pretty much goes from July through mid-November, there will be groups and groups of Christians who are taking off time from work, sometimes leaving their families, but many times bringing their entire families with them, if it's at all possible, and just spending times waking up. I believe they woke up before 4 o'clock in the morning for prayer service, had breakfast at 5, and were at the vineyards by 6, largely because the grapes have to be picked at a very early time, depending on their pH balance. There's a whole science behind that, which don't think of Tommy as a very basic, a primitive farmer. He's a very high-tech and understands all of the secrets and all of the basics to make a very complex and highly sought-after and, frankly, internationally award-winning wines.
Really, it was an amazing experience and really something to see. Hundreds and hundreds of Christians. How long do they typically come for? 3-4 weeks or 2 weeks or whatever people want.
2-3-4 weeks. It's difficult to get a lot of time off from work because most of them have normal jobs in the States. And not just the States. It's I think 20 different countries were there last night, and they have countries, some European countries.
And they've created their own village on another windy mountaintop in the Shomron. From where they, as we're recording this right now on mid-morning, they're probably almost done with their day's work, harvesting grapes. And I think they said that in this session, this two-week session, they are responsible, did they say, for 91,000 bottles of wine?
I believe so.
91,000 bottles of wine. This amazing group of Christian pilgrims have brought about. Quick break, and then we'll finish off with Judith talking about how her life has been impacted and literally what she feels about living right here. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, and I'll be back with you in just a moment.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Jeff Fisher Show.
Don't feel sorry for me. I just want you to know that it gets really hot in your automobile when there's no air conditioning and it's the middle of the afternoon and you're driving on the 20-lane highway. My kids, no, I don't want to go in Daddy's car. It's too hot.
Tough. In the back seat. Suck it up.
Dad, it's really hot back here. The sun is really blasting through these windows, Dad. Do you think maybe you could do to just try?
No. Sit back there and shut up.
The Jeff Fisher Show. Saturday mornings, 9 to noon Eastern.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
With stories in the areas of family, friendship, faith, and finance, this is Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Only on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
On with the Rabbi Daniel Lapin Show, where the more that things change, the more we need to depend on those things that never change. And one of the things that never changes, of course, is the land of Israel. It is, it was, and it will. And here is Judith to talk a little bit about her feelings about being right over here.
Thank you, Rabbi. I think what I would have to say is, as somebody who did not grow up particularly Bible-believing and traditionally religious, and who came to it later in life, one of the things that I experienced as a Jew who now kept kosher and now kept the Sabbath was that I felt like a second-class citizen in America. And later, as my political views also shifted and I became more conservative, I also, again, felt like a second-class citizen. I felt that it was me and, thank God, the rest of the Bible-believing members of American society. I felt like it was us against the world, and it was us against more and more, a larger and larger part of American society. Eventually, I came to the point where I felt that that to raise my daughters the way I wanted to raise them, I had to protect them. I had to insulate them. I can only imagine that this is a feeling that many people have. My close Christian friends and my close Jewish friends often spoke about this, that we needed a shield around our families. As a Jew, I had an opportunity that's not open to everyone, which is that I could move to Israel and be welcomed as a brother, as a sister into this community. I live in a place where, though this is incomprehensible for me to say it, every single one of my neighbors shares my values. Because I live in what you call the settlements, everybody also carries a gun. That's nice, because then I get to practice my targets with other nice neighbors. I feel like I live in a place with people who share my values. In America, there were many people who shared my values as well. However, we felt that we were the minority. We felt that we were under attack. And here, I feel as though I'm normative. That is one of the wonderful things about living here, is that I live in a community with people who I don't have to be concerned what my child is going to learn at my neighbor's house, because I know they're going to learn the same values I have. There also is something to be said, though, I want to mention, as being a Jew, living in a Jewish country, where I do feel a kinship, even with the Jews here who are more secular. We're all part of the same people. And that's very powerful for me. With that said, I left behind family and I left behind friends. And it's extremely difficult to do that. It's a 7 or 10 hour time difference from my family and friends in America. There are days that go by where, because of my responsibilities here, I literally miss that small window of time when they're available and I'm available to talk. That's painful. That's difficult. And I think anybody who moves across the globe has that experience. To me, it was worth it. And I don't regret it one moment. But I do want to say I'm an American citizen and I'm a proud American citizen. It simply came to a time in my decision making where I had to say, what was the most important thing in my life? Was it my American citizenship and loyalty and love of our founders? Or was it my religion and my ability to be amongst the founders of Israel? It's like I could go live with the Thomas Jefferson generation for my people. And I have to say, as someone who was raised with a huge love of America and huge patriotism, how could I not take the opportunity to be amongst the builders of my nation that, as we all know, the founders based their nation of America very much on biblical principles. And now I had the opportunity to do that. So I said goodbye to my family and friends, and I have a difficult time difference. But what I've gained is so much more.
Judith, do you not feel alone here with family and friends back in the United States? Just on an emotional level, I mean, do you feel that you stand alone and isolated when Ellie is an advisor to government, he's an advisor to business, he leaves the house, here you are? Do you feel alone, or do you feel there are people who have your back?
To say that people have my back would be an understatement. You know, you spoke, Rabbi, beautifully about you see the army truck go by, and you it's a breath of relief. For me, I probably know the guys on that truck. Every single person here serves in the Army. I watch the young men who become bar mitzvah and then join the Army. I cannot emphasize how you can't say thank you for your service here in Israel, because you'll be saying it to every single person you meet on the street. We think of each other all as cousins. I'd say every Israeli I meet, every Jew I meet is like my third cousin. They're on one hand giving me very in-my-face advice. How come your kid doesn't have sunscreen on? Those aren't good shoes for running. And at the same time, they're going to turn to me and say, do you need a ride? Can I do anything to help? You made Aliyah from America. Oh, welcome, welcome. Everyone has my back. And it's not just because they have my back because they're family. They also have my back because people here, it is a trained nation. This is a country of people who are raised to know not only how to use a gun, but how to defend themselves, what to do in an emergency situation, and to be grateful, grateful every day for the blessing of living in this land.
Thank you. Thank you, Judith. And Susan, how are we doing? It's I know Susan's lost her voice a little bit, but it's wonderful, isn't it, to be here?
It's fantastic.
It really is. And Bluma, we sort of last, we're going to go around last comments before Susan and I race back to Jerusalem for the Sabbath. Bluma, I saw you. Your expression was changing while Judith was talking. Do you want to tell me just what was going on in your mind there?
Judith's been here 6 years, and I've only been here 2 months. And just thinking about how much I miss my family is so hard. But then, you know, you go to a grocery store, and you drop something on the ground, or you don't understand where you are. You know, or what does this say on this box? Is this a good price or whatever? All these questions when you don't understand anything. You know, I don't understand anything yet. And just how grateful people are when I say, I'm a new immigrant, I say in Hebrew, my, you know, very limited Hebrew. I'm a new immigrant, you know, excuse me. What can we do to help you? How they act, they give me the sense that I am not alone at all. And I'm surrounded by my family. And so it is a very conflicting existence for a new immigrant who I get on the phone and I hear my sibling's voice, or my mother, or my father, or my brother, my sisters, you know, just how you forget how much you miss them when you hear their voice because you're surrounded by family here. It is a heavy decision to make. I don't know that I've said that, but I want to say that. I want to register. I said the other day, I wish America, I look forward to things being better there so I can feel better about leaving in some ways. So I just, yeah, thanks for letting me say that.
Yeah, I know just what you mean. And Steve, some last thoughts before I have to wish you Shabbat Shalom and head back to Jerusalem.
Thank you very much, Rabbi and Susan. I just want to say, just listen to everybody. It just brings up a lot of emotion. And, you know, makes me feel part of something big here, part of history. And that's why we're here.
and I really appreciate it. Every single day I wake up, I can't believe I'm living in Israel, and I love living here. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. And Ellie, we're going to have more time to chat, of course, on the drive back to Jerusalem. Susan, I want to thank you very much indeed for making it possible for us to spend 24 hours in the Shomron with you and Judith. And thank you for a wonderful, restful sleep last night and for breakfast this morning, but above all, for exposing us to some of the extraordinary people that we've met, including that woman tour guide who's another one. You seem to have a lot of best friends around here, by the way, as we were driving through the Shomron. Every time Ellie would stop and say, oh, I've got to just go say hello to that person, or we've got to say hello to that person. We went to look down at Joseph's tomb in the city of Shechem, and there was a group of soldiers being, I don't know, it must have been about 50 or 60 IDF soldiers, being given orientation. They were replacing an outgoing team of security people, and they were going to be taking over, and they were sort of where we were at this overlook, looking down at this teeming, squalid refugee camp where Arabs are kept in a deliberate state of seething discontent, not by the Israelis, let that be clear, but by their own people to be used as political pawns. And even there, there was an elderly gentleman you knew that that you ran over and introduced us to. It's all been very, very exciting. Some closing thoughts of yours before I have to wrap up this part of today's show and allow us to head back to Jerusalem.
My closing thought is that, you know, those of us who have moved to Israel this year are really the first or maybe the second generation of Jews in world history who have come to Israel by choice. The first Jew, Abraham, came follow God's instructions. A few generations later, the Jews didn't go; weren't as enthusiastic as they needed to be about going to the land of Israel and spent 40 years in the wilderness. And eventually they were, again, forced to go in. There have been times when Jews came back in Aliyah at the beginning of the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. It was largely because of anti-Semitism that they were running away from. We are really the first generation of Jews who are leaving five-bedroom homes with swimming pools and traveling to Israel on a dream and a hope and a belief. So it is remarkably part of that. And the thing that I was not expecting, which I should have because I have a rabbi, and I should have known this in advance, is that there is a certain vibrancy in the kinds of largely Americans or immigrants who have come to Israel with that ideology. We come here, and the ideology doesn't end when you enter the land, when you go through Ben-Gurion Airport. It continues in business, and you see a lot of entrepreneurship, see a lot of people taking risks. We came here to make a difference in our own spiritual lives, and it spills over into every aspect of our life, in working in from a community level, doing charity, all sorts of things like that, businesses, and that ideology will continue to grow. And one of the symbols of success of the Jewish people is when the Jewish people are behaving properly in the land of Israel, things seem to go well and prosper. And I think that's a very optimistic note, and one that all of your students and all of your listeners can very well attest to. And hopefully, for those of us Jews in Israel, you can see that, and Christians, wherever you are, when you're sticking to the words of the Bible and having a rabbi to steer you when you don't always understand what the Bible is telling you, that's a recipe for success.
Thank you again, Ellie, and thanks all of you for sharing with us today. It's been a privilege for Susan and I to spend a little time with you. We appreciate it. And I can only tell you, you all seem to be thriving. Your children seem to be thriving. They seem to revel in a sense of freedom and openness here that they didn't have, although they lived as well as anyone could live in the United States of America. There is something special. Your kids really do seem to be thriving in a very, very beautiful way. So thanks so much. We really appreciate being together with you, and look forward, God willing, on towards future occasions when we'll be able to visit again and share together with you. The Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show will continue in just a moment, but as we continue, just me alone after this uplifting opportunity to hear from people who, as Ellie correctly said, nobody was chasing these people away. They were not escaping deprivation or hardship. They were not leaving from, they were coming to. And there's a lot to think about right there. Back with you in just a moment, folks. I am your rabbi, Rabbi Daniel Lappin.
There's still more to come from Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
If you're in the market for a new mattress, Casper.com/rabbi should be the next website you visit. Casper created an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's one perfect mattress, and it's sold directly to you, eliminating the need to endure one of those commission salesman mattress stores with inflated prices. Casper is shipped for free right to your door, astonishingly delivered in a sleek, how did it fit in their box? You just let it unfold, and there you have it, one of the most supportive sleep surfaces ever designed. Hassle-free. Casper is made in America, and Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. Breathable latex and memory foams are combined for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Try Casper for 100 nights free, and if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Right now, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/rabbi. That's casper.com, promo code rabbi. Terms and conditions apply. casper.com/rabbi.
Welcome back to Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Yes, your rabbi, Rabbi Daniel Lappin, that's me, continuing with the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Thanks again for being part of the show, and thanks for sticking with me all the way right till here. And I've often thought about the remarkable altruism and idealism of America's founders. And as I mentioned earlier, it's been so fascinating during my visit to Israel to see Americans infused with this passionate and zealous commitment to acting in accordance with a set of values rather than acting in accordance with the requirements of expediency. What do I mean by that? Well, acting in accordance with the requirements of expediency means that you run your life and you make the decisions that life involves us in every single day, many times a day usually. We make those decisions on the basis of our own survival, physical survival, our own comfort, our own luxuries, our own benefits. Things that make our physical survival more certain and more pleasurable. That's the rational and expedient way of making decisions. But when an American soldier in Iraq saves the lives of his team by risking his own and sometimes losing his own, he knows what he's doing. That is acting in accordance with a set of values, not in accordance with the requirements of expediency. Expediency would say, get out of there. Who cares what happens to everybody else? And those people who think that biological determinism has a lot to do with life would say, you owe it to your genes to get out of there. Let the grenade explode. Let it blow up whoever it blows up, as long as that's not you. Because your responsibility is to preserve your genetic elements. Okay, so clearly, when the signers of the Declaration of Independence pledged their fortunes and their sacred honor, they knew they were pledging their lives. And in fact, for many of them, that's pretty much what happened. They knew that their actions were driven not by expediency, because the rational, expedient thing to do was to stay out of the fire, to make certain that you did not become a target of the British. Just mind your own business, take no sides, stay neutral. But these were people who demonstrated remarkable idealism and commitment to a set of values. And they did that knowing it would impact their comfort, their security, and their very lives. That is idealism. That is altruism. And there have been times, time and time again, twice America stepped in to rescue the old world, once during the First World War and once during the Second World War. And Americans enlisted in huge numbers to be part of that. To a large extent, there was also altruism. To a large extent, not on the part of the country, but on the part of the individuals who enlisted, the individuals who fought heroically, North Africa, the Pacific Theater, Europe, East, everywhere. It was a world war. This was extraordinary. And I believe that America has always generated a disproportionate number of heroes, a disproportionate number of people who are able to act, willing to act, according to values rather than according to expediency, according to belief systems rather than according to the requirements of keeping their body alive and comfortable. People who see the survival of the soul as every bit as important as the survival of the body. And so, why would it be that America has produced a disproportionate number of people like that, and so has Judaism? Right? Throughout the centuries, as a matter of fact, on the Day of Atonement, which is only a few days ago from when I'm recording this show, on the Day of Atonement, there is a prayer that was actually composed by a Rabbi Amnon in Germany 1,000 years ago. Right, 1,000 years ago, 11th century. And what happened is that, and you know, I tell his story just to highlight it, but there are thousands of accounts like this. This is a very big part of Jewish history, namely refusing to give up your faith, refusing to betray God, and in exchange, being executed. And the Rabbi Amnon story is that he was given 3 days to agree to convert. He was a very important Jewish leader, and in those days in Germany, Catholicism was effectively the ruling class, the ecclesiastical authority and political authority were one and the same thing for the most part. And it was deemed necessary to have a very visible Jew convert to Catholicism. And they gave him 3 days. And or actually, they told him, he asked for 3 days to think about it. And what happened was, during the 3 days, he was overcome with remorse and in tremendous self-flagellation, as he said, "What a terrible thing I did to even give them the idea that for 3 days I was seriously contemplating this." And they brought him, they summoned him after 3 days, and they said, "Well, what is your decision?" He said, "My decision is that my tongue should be torn out for having even said the words, 'Give me 3 days to consider.'" And in fury, the authority said to him, "No, it's not your tongue. It's your legs and your hands we'll start with." And they amputated his arms and his legs joint by joint over a very lengthy period. And they carried him home and dropped him in his bed. And this took place just a day or so before Yom Kippur, before the Day of Atonement, about 1,000 years ago. And while he was dying, he composed a prayer, and he asked to be carried into the synagogue. And his mutilated body, as he was dying, was carried back to the synagogue, where, summoning up all his strength, he sang out the words of the prayer that he had composed, and which found its way into the liturgy to the present day. This is very common. Look, what could be a better example of idealism, where there is just a willingness to place the survival, or let alone the comfort of the body, making it very secondary to the survival of the soul and the spirit. It's a remarkable thing. Why is America so disproportionate in the number of people that it produces of this kind of dedication? And by the way, I see it all the time in the present. I know pastors I support who go into Muslim countries to bring Christianity there. Some have lost their lives, some are in danger of losing their lives, and it's exactly the same thing. It's this incredible ability to run your life according to a set of values, idealistically, rather than rationally and expediently. And it's what produces greatness in a people, in a society, in a nation, and it's something that ought to be celebrated amazingly. There are pastors who go on missions. There are pastors who set up churches in difficult and remote locations. There are the wives who accompany them. There are the children who become part of their ministry. And just as a matter of fact, last night I had a chance to meet Pastor Tommy Waller and his wife, who spend 5 or 6 months a year on a bleak, windswept, remote mountaintop in Israel, on Mount Gerizim. You may remember from the scripture from the book of Deuteronomy how Moses set up blessings and curses. On Mount Ebal would be the curses, on Mount Gerizim would be the blessings, and the city of Shechem lies in the valley between, and that's where the people of Israel were. And Pastor Tommy Waller brings hundreds of Christians who pay their own way to come and support Israel, to work in the vineyards and pick the grapes during the harvesting season. I saw these people, I spoke to them, and in hindsight, I'm very sorry that I did not record my remarks to them, because I think many of you would have liked it, but I think they recorded it, and if I'm able to get a copy of the audio, I will include it in a future show. But let's just spend just a moment on this question of why is it that both America and Israel, both America and the people of the descendants of Abraham, why are these people those who produce this kind of dedication, this kind of altruism, this kind of idealism? Now, look, let me be very direct and candid here. I'm not comparing it. I'm not saying it's the same thing. But let's admit that a Mohammed Atta and his 18 collaborators who flew jets into American buildings and ultimately into the ground, killing thousands of Americans as well as taking their own lives, you might say that there's something similar there too, right? After all, you could hardly say they lived expediently. You could hardly say they made the rational decisions. From the perspective of biological determinism, they certainly didn't protect their genes. But there is a difference. And the difference is, if you are willing to sacrifice your comfort, you're willing to sacrifice your fortune, you're willing even to sacrifice your life for an uplifting divine ideal. That's one thing. But in order to merely take the lives of others and being willing to lose your life in that, not exactly the same thing. Right? It isn't exactly the same. But there is something special going on here. And I'll tell you what it is. And it's something that we'd probably want to explore a little bit more fully at another time, but at least for now, I can give you a little bit of a picture, because what I want to explain is that it is a connection with God that allows people to be idealistic. It is, and again, I'm not saying there are no atheistic idealists. It does happen, but I'm speaking about within a culture, within a large population, within the evolution of a society and of a culture. A society and a culture that is God-centric is more likely to produce a disproportionate number of idealists than an utterly materialistic secular society. And again, if you think about it, this isn't such a shocking disclosure, because if you are a materialistic individual, if your outlook is purely secular and materialistic, then obviously losing all you have is your physical life, there's nothing else, and to sacrifice it or risk it or in any way diminish its effectiveness, why do that? There is nothing else. All you have is your body. But to those who have a Bible vision and a Bible-centric view of the world, well, then we know that we are made up of not only body, but body and soul, and that they are of similar importance, and that the protection and preservation of the soul is every bit as important as protection and preservation of the body. And so it's perfectly logical that people for whom a spiritual reality is part of their world are more likely to sacrifice the body for the spirit. But for those who hold of no spirit and who merely celebrate the body, well, it's unreasonable to expect altruism or idealism there, surely. And there's one other aspect to it that that I think we need to wrap up with, and we'll do that just as soon as we come back. But meanwhile, a quick reminder, I want you to visit the website. As you know, right now, there's a terrific price on the library pack. And those of you who have not yet invested in a library pack, I'd love it if you take care of that business and do it now. Not only will you be receiving information and guidance that can literally transform your life and reorient you in ways that are better than maybe ways you're in now that do not satisfy you, and aspects of your existence that that don't please you, the guidance and also the fuel to propel you in a new direction is what I have embedded in the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Library Pack. So go take a look at that, please, at rabbidaniellappin.com, and take a look and see. You or somebody you want to bless would be a very worthy recipient of something which is really my life work. That's really what it is. Back with you in just a moment.
Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Don't miss the Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip.
Now, anything racial can be made racist, and sometimes even things that aren't racist or racial can be claimed to be racism. We've been talking about reparations for slavery. It's for little things that you may have done or said that made somebody feel bad. They're not talking about helping all people. They're talking about helping some people.
The Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip. Weekday mornings, 6 to 9 Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
We now return with Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Okay. The more that things change, the more we have to depend upon those things that never change. Remember, you heard that from your rabbi. That's me, Rabbi Daniel Lappin, here on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Thank you for being a part of it. And what we're talking about is one of the very interesting differences between secular materialism, what you find in socialism and in its little sister, liberalism, and its next little sister, progressivism. What you have in all of these things, something which is an absolutely consistent characteristic in all of these things, is an obsession on certainty, an obsession with being able to lock everything in. And this is how things are, and this is how things are going to be. And so even socialistic economic plans and economic policies are all predicated on this idea that we'll have a five-year plan, Stalin said, and every liberal that followed him always said, we'll have a three-year plan, a five-year plan, this is what we'll do. Look, I have to tell you that I shudder with dismay when I hear politicians saying, this is what I shall do. Listen, the truth is, all I really want to hear from a politician is, I'll tell you what, I'll get out of your way. And I will make sure that as few people as possible interfere with you reaching your highest potential, fulfilling yourself as you wish, seeking happiness in your own way. I will try and keep the government out of your way, and I'll try and keep any fellow citizens who wish you harm out of your way. God bless you. You go ahead. That's what I really want to hear from politicians. It's all I want to hear from politicians. But when they assure me that we will reduce the deficit by this amount and we'll do this and we'll do that, you know, you're pretending that you live in a world of certainty. You're pretending you live in a mechanistic world where you can press a button, close a circuit, and make a light bulb go on. And maybe you can do that with an electric circuit, but you can't do that with human lives. You can't do that with human societies. The world in which God put us is a world of uncertainty, not a world of certainty, right? You don't really know, right, that you're going to have a tomorrow. There's no guarantee of that. So somebody says, well, in that case, I may as well just eat, drink, and be merry today. Why should I bother going to work? Why should I bother with doing anything? Because who knows, there may not be a tomorrow. That's true. We live in an uncertain world. However, we have to function, and we have to learn to function with a veneer of certainty that we place over it. And if you think about biblical civilization, you think about Judeo-Christian tradition, what it is doing for us is creating a veneer of certainty, creating an interface between us with who yearn for certainty with every microscopic morsel of our being, and a world in which there is no certainty. So much so, by the way, that even the study of physics and the development of quantum mechanics, which lay at the heart of really beginning to understand the secrets of the universe and the secrets of the atom, all of these things depended on things like, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, for one thing, which speaks about how certain complementary values are such that you can't know them both. And if you know one thing, then by definition, you can't possibly know another. Without getting too technical, the bottom line is that it describes a world, and it's an accurate mathematical description of the world, of uncertainty, where we just don't really have total certainty. Secularism functions with certainty. And if certainty is the goal and the be-all, and you see yourself living in a world where all things can be established, guaranteed, locked in, well, then you're going to start doing some really, really bad things. You are going to start legislating car safety to such an extent that nobody can afford a car anymore. And to this very day, we've made it impossible for somebody to say, you know, I'm a starter, I don't have a lot of money, I want to buy a basic car. I don't need side reinforcing, I don't need airbags, I don't need all that thing. You know, if when I get older and I have a family and I have more responsibilities, then I'll buy that kind of... You can't do that anymore, because laws in America for many, many years already have been made by people with a vision of certainty. But biblical faith gives us the capacity to live happily in a world with no certainty, but to live with at least the conditions of certainty around us. So I may not know for sure if I'm here tomorrow. That's true. But my faith may make certain that I get up in the morning and I do all the same things today that I did yesterday and just that I hope to be able to do tomorrow. All of these things, all in order to create a cocoon of certainty around us, even though that's not the world in which God placed us. God placed us in a world of uncertainty in order to give us the challenge of functioning, to give us the challenge of growing, because only big people can live happily and comfortably with uncertainty. Small people need everything locked in. Small people need everything tied down. I was always willing, together with my wife, to allow our children a great deal of autonomy. And we used to have busybodies sometimes poking their nose into our business and say, you know, how can you let your child go by themselves? Or how can you do this? Or how can you do that? You know, we look, for better or for worse, I'm sure I can be criticized as a parent. But yes, I mean, we let our 9-year-old and 11-year-old daughters take a Greyhound bus to spend 2 days in Vancouver from Seattle. Now, we took certain precautions, but we still let them do it. And as you can imagine, people gave us, certain people criticized. Look, I am very comfortable living in a world of uncertainty. I try as much as possible to bring certainty as much as is feasible, but I don't go crazy. I don't go nuts about it because I accept that I'm living in a world where things are not automatically certain. It's liberating. It gives us a certain freedom to function. It allows you to invest. It allows you to take risks. But when you live a materialistic lifestyle based on secular liberalism, then your quest is for certainty. And you try so hard to make certain that your children can never hurt themselves in any way whatsoever that you end up stifling their development. These are just some of the enormous problems that come about in an attempt to pretend that God put us in a world of certainty when he didn't. He put us in a world of uncertainty. And knowing and accepting that that uncertainty is a part of life is what allows idealism and altruism to take root, and idealism and altruism to express themselves. And so each and every one of you, you are charitable people. You reach into your pocket, you take money that could be spent on your own comfort, on your own security, and you give it away to a cause. That is altruism. That is idealism. And it is found, and this is a statistic that is well established, this is a quality and a characteristic that is found overwhelmingly among people who are faithful to the Judeo-Christian tradition, people who are Jewish or Christian, faithful to the biblical vision. Overwhelmingly, America's most charitable people are religious Christians and religious Jews. Overwhelmingly. That, by the way, is just not up for argument. It's a known fact. And the reason is it makes perfect sense. Because when you are able to live knowingly in a world of uncertainty, just like Schrodinger did, of the famous Schrodinger equation, or Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg of the uncertainty principle. These are men who understood how the world really works. They did. And they understood that uncertainty lay at its heart. And so we too, we get that. And so whether it is on the hilltops of the Shomron, where Jews and Christians are planting civilization where none existed for 2,000 years, whether it is in America, where people who are devoted to their faith build and construct and give and help and show compassion, or whether it's Christians in America who help countries that have undergone calamity, or Christians in America who go to carry the message of their faith to the lands of hostile and aggressive barbarians, God bless you all. Because what we're talking about is people who have learned through religion to come to terms with the uncertainties of the world in which we live. And so until next week, when God willing, we shall be together again, I wish for each and every one of you a week of good health and prosperity. God bless you all.
The Blaze on Demand.
This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin.